Hello, everybody. This is John Marks, the editor of CopsAlive.com. I want to welcome you to another edition of Cops Alive Audio Bulletin, where our guest today is Lisa Wimberger. Before we get started, I want to remind you that Cops Alive was founded to provide information, strategies, and other tools to help police officers successfully survive their careers. We work with law enforcement officers and their agencies to prepare for the risks that threaten their existence, and we do this by helping them plan for happy, healthy, and successful lives, both on the job and beyond. And one of the ways we do that are through training programs and our web blog called Cops Alive, as well as podcasts like this one. And I am very pleased to introduce our guest to you today. She's somebody that I just met recently, but have been very impressed with what she's doing. Her name is Lisa Wimberger, and as I mentioned, she's the founder and CEO of Trance Personnel Consulting Group, or TPCG. And she has a very interesting background, but what she spends her time doing now is working with law enforcement officers and staff members and law enforcement agencies to provide preventative stress management programs that help officers deal with everything from mild stress challenges all the way up to severe post-traumatic stress disorder. And without any further ado, Lisa, I want to welcome you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Would you share with the audience a little bit of information about first what it is you do, because I can't describe it nearly as well as you can, and maybe tell me how you got into this position of doing this kind of training for law enforcement?
Absolutely. What I'm doing, I found, is filling a very unique niche in the market, in the law enforcement market. There's very little preventative stress management programs. I've done my homework. I've done my research. I can't seem to find agencies that have any kind of comprehensive stress management program. There's this amazing internal network of post-crisis intervention. There's amazing staff, psychologists, and debrief sessions when an officer goes through critical incident. And there's all of this internal support post-crisis.
Right.
And what I've found in my research and in my experience is that there are a vast number of officers that suffer greatly and never go through a critical incident. So they don't ever get the debrief. They don't even know they're suffering the levels of stress and trauma that they are, sometimes directly, sometimes vicariously. And these officers burn out fast. They burn out under the radar. Their home lives explode. Their professional lives explode. And they're left with no assistance and no recognition. And sometimes they're left with the stigma of failure. And there's a way to really prevent all that, and it's a little bit of forethought, it's a little bit of budget planning, and it's a little bit of agencies recognizing we have a national crisis here. We have a field or a profession that suffers the highest suicide rates out of any other profession.
Mm-hmm.
There's something wrong with that picture.
Mm-hmm.
There's something wrong with the statistics. When you have an officer who puts himself in the line of duty every single day, and he's dealing with violence and weapons, and yet the statistics for suicide far exceed the statistics of officers dying in the line of duty, something is seriously wrong with this structure. And that's really what I'm doing, is I'm creating preventative stress management training. I'm not doing lecture. I'm not doing motivational speaking. There's plenty of great people in the industry who take care of that for me. I'm not doing counseling. There's plenty of great industry people taking care of that for me. What I'm doing is what it seems like nobody else is doing. I'm creating a program with hands-on techniques and tools to teach officers, what do you do if you are experiencing this type of stress beyond eating right, working out, and finding someone to talk to? What do you do beyond that that actually gives you navigation capabilities to ride through this traumatic cycle that's about to hit you, or that you're in the middle of, or that you somehow feel like you can't get out of. There are processes and methods that are simple and easy to follow, and if you do them, you start to develop navigation capabilities so that you can find your way through some of these cycles that typically dismantle officers, really first responders in general.
Right.
But I've chosen to start with the law enforcement world because it's, from my personal experience, this is where I saw the most need. So I've really started there. But at some point, it's beyond officers, really. I mean, it's first responders as well.
Well, and even at Cops Alive, we talk about, you know, there's an awful lot of support staff in law enforcement that probably suffer as much, certainly a high degree of stress that oftentimes they can't manage. For example, communications personnel and dispatchers that have to hear about everything over the radio or through the phone line and have no direct impact on any resolution. And I've been told by many of them that that leaves them oftentimes hanging and with no resolution and no way to manage that kind of stress.
There is an audience out there of dispatchers, evidence technicians, the unsworn staff, all of the people still involved in the process and the day-to-day occurrences that go on for an officer. And these people are perceived to be behind the scenes, and a lot of times they get overlooked because they're not on the scene. But from my experience doing this with the dispatchers and the evidence technicians, they're suffering vicarious trauma on levels that most people don't understand. I mean, it's the evidence technician that gets to hold the wallet of the deceased or the wedding ring or whatever article. They're physically holding these things, and they go home and they have nightmares just as an officer might who was at the scene. And sometimes it's no worse. It's just different. Sometimes it's the dispatchers and the evidence technicians that develop PTSD, sometimes quicker because there is no closure. They don't get to see the body being put in the ambulance. They don't get to have the closure of seeing what happened at the scene. They go home with the questions, the voices, and the imagination that takes them on their own journey through stress and trauma. So I always include, when I deal with agencies, I always include and recommend the unsworn staff and or the behind-the-scenes, quote-unquote, behind-the-scenes players as well, because they're dealing with this same level of trauma. It's just affecting them slightly differently.
You shared with me some family connections, and I'd love to have you tell everyone why you got involved in this in the first place and how it really hits home for you.
Yeah. So my experience, I grew up in New York on Long Island, which is a very insulated place. And most people, I'm taking a wild guess here, one out of every five of my friends ended up being NYPD or NYFD. That's just what you do. You know, it's a great career. It affords a very nice lifestyle on Long Island, and you go and you work in Manhattan, and then you come home to the suburbs. Or you work in Nassau County, and you live a very, very comfortable lifestyle. So most of the people I grew up with were in that profession.
Yeah.
And I grew up with my brother's friends. One in particular I'm thinking of, he was a firefighter. He would come and he would eat dinner at the house, and we would have casual dinner conversation. And the conversation was this. He was an EMT in the Bronx. And for kicks on a Saturday night, the paramedics would get these prank calls. And they'd rush out to a location, and there'd be a bunch of bored kids sitting on the porch or the stoop, and no, man, we didn't call you. No, we didn't call you. I don't know what you're doing here. Meanwhile, there's someone across town dying, and there's no paramedic there to help them.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, you know, this would develop into this started to become, you know, more of a cynical story, more of a, you know, we should make them pay for these types of behaviors, until the point where one day this particular friend of ours came to dinner, and he said, I have to quit. I think I killed a man yesterday. And this was casual dinner conversation. He showed up. It was the third prank call in a short amount of time to the same location, and they did not want to go back to the hospital without a body because that would have been a wasted trip. So they beat the person on the porch to a bloody pulp to take a body back so that their job was justified. And it, this kind of thing happens all the time. And he was telling us this and saying, I don't think I can do this anymore. So from there, he became a firefighter, and it only got worse from there with him. But the other really profound experience for me, aside from watching my friends who were New York City Transit cops in the subway suffer severe post-traumatic stress disorder. One friend lost all the hair on his body within a month of taking the job. He developed a neurotic condition. But it was really my cousin who is a retired NYPD detective. His spiral was long and slow and obvious to everyone but himself. So there wasn't any one particular incident that drove him to unravel. The unraveling started early on in his career, and he was always very sweet, always sweet to the family, but he became an alcoholic. He was probably using drugs. We don't really know the extent of that. And I got to watch him dismantle my family. Mm-hmm. And I remember having these conversations where my family member would say to me, he urinated in the dresser drawer, and our children saw it, and he doesn't even remember. He would come home that intoxicated with loaded weapons, and this was kind of blackout behavior, but his children were seeing this, and he was at Ground Zero during 9/11. Of course, that doesn't help anything, and that's an unimaginable a critical incident that I can't even fathom having been there and gone through it. Mm-hmm. But it only got worse from there for him. And it occurred to me years ago when I was asked to assist his son who was battling severe depression. This kid was 16 and he was battling severe depression because of the vicarious trauma that his father was bringing home and how the archetypal cop family suffers from untreated stress. He was dealing with all of that. So I began teaching him these techniques to help him put himself back together. You know, it's very sad when you're 16 and you're being medicated for clinical depression. You should be playing baseball and enjoying your life. So these tools I started teaching to his son and realized that there was a level of trauma that these tools could help people in that profession deal with. There was a component of these tools that could help prevent people from desensitizing to the violence around them and therefore then prevent them from participating in that violence, either towards, inward violence towards themselves or outward violence to justify their job.
Yeah.
So that's really what sparked me, my move into law enforcement with these particular techniques.
Either the audience can identify because they know somebody exactly like the person you're describing or the people you're describing, or they have seen it around them. And, you're describing cops' kids. There's all kinds of offshoots of the stress that we pick up in our jobs. And obviously you've identified some techniques and tools that can maybe help us deal with some of that.
Yeah, the techniques and tools, they're very powerful. I want to talk a little bit about them because they are unique. There's plenty of great stress management training out there. I've been through a bunch of it, and a lot of it is what I've found. There's been a little bit of process and method given to me, but a lot of times it's very motivational. And that's a really important component. You need to be motivated to change. But The motivation goes away very quickly if there's no roadmap to apply it to. And I find that's the piece I want to give during, you know, in this program. So the program really takes four techniques that I teach as the base core of this program. So the first technique really is all of it is framed as a way to sort of rewire your neurological response to stress. Normally, when we get a stress, whether it's a positive stress or a negative stress, what we do is we turn our adrenaline on and we ride through that stress more functional because we're using adrenaline. And what that feels like is a bit of a buzz. But then the stressor goes away and the adrenaline has to come down, and that feels terrible.
Right.
But we don't know that's a normal thing. So we mislabel that. So all of a sudden we start to feel exhausted, depressed, not quite as alive as we did an hour ago when we were going through that thing we were going through. Mm-hmm. And we kind of want to tune out. And over time, we start to want to avoid that letdown. But that letdown is what the body needs to really repair. Because if we keep spiking the adrenaline and feeling alive all the time, we burn our bodies out physically. We burn our bodies out. And of course, on a neurological level, we are frying ourselves at that level of performance. So what the first tool I teach is a way to have officers identify, number one, when they are in an adrenaline spike, even if that adrenaline spike is caused by getting into the patrol car. Nothing has happened yet, but suddenly you're amped about going on patrol.
Mm-hmm.
You've just increased your adrenaline. So we teach officers how to identify when there's a shift in their adrenaline level and then how to start turning that down when we don't need to use it that high. You mm-hmm. absolutely need to run on high adrenaline in the moment on a call, but you don't need it while you're doing your paperwork. And so I start to teach officers, how do you turn it down? How do you recognize when it's up, and how do you turn it down? Because that's the very first, most important thing your body wants to do in order to start repairing the damage that adrenaline has caused your body. I'm not even going to go into all the damage that adrenaline does to the body over sustained periods of time. But that's the first technique. The second technique takes the officer from that new place of, okay, I can turn the adrenaline down a little bit, to a place of, now I want to get neutral to this so I don't hold on to it. Because that's part of what happens with PTSD. You are repeating this program, this memory, this thought, this emotion. You get into this repetitive process and you can't get out of it. So the second tool really teaches officers, how do I now take what has happened and frame it in a neutral space so I can sort of file it, you know?
Yeah.
It's really about creating a file system for those particular adrenaline spikes so you don't automatically go back to it as a default. What we're doing with these tools is we are rewiring the default patterns that keep us in these destructive cycles. The third technique is a way for officers to start identifying now, okay, there's obviously other influences ping-ponging me around other than my own internal thoughts. What are those external influences? Is there something going on with my partner that is triggering me every time?
Mm-hmm.
Is there something going on with the people in my close proximity that is ping-ponging me around into an adrenaline pattern that I don't particularly need? So it's a way for officers to start identifying what is theirs and what is not theirs.
Yeah.
And what's not theirs, they can create a file system for that. And then the fourth technique is once you've identified, you've filed it so that you can move on and you now have deciphered what's yours and what's not yours. The fourth technique is let's now create a new default for your nervous system so that we start to slowly erase the nervous system pattern that says spike adrenaline when you encounter this type of thing, and we erase it, and the officer gets to rewrite that sort of neurological default to something healthier for them. So it's really creating navigation for your nervous system. And that's what's different about this program than a lot of the other stress management programs. But I don't even – sometimes I call it emotional survival. However, there is a fantastic man who's out there on the circuit doing emotional survival for law enforcement training, and that's Dr. Gil Martin, and he's amazing. And he really sets a great stage, a platform for me, and I'm very grateful to him. He helps officers identify what that cycle looks like, and then I get to go in and say, you know what? Here's what you can do now that you've identified what it looks like. Here are your navigation tools.
Well, and I want to compliment you on that, too, because like everybody, I've been through a number of stress management programs, but it was kind of the flavor of the month where you got some, you're probably right, motivation about changing, and then not really the tools to put into place. And from, I haven't seen your training program yet, but from the people I've talked to, there were some rave reviews from the Denver Police Department and other locals here in Colorado that really talked about how tangible your techniques were to actually, you know, dealing with some of the problems.
Yeah, I found that it's very interesting dealing with this audience because, of course, in the training, everyone has on a poker face. And
really?
they're pretty good at the poker face.
Yep.
And so what I have to go in with is understanding I am giving something really important to individuals who want to have it. And I'm not there to make individuals who don't want it swallow a pill they don't want to swallow. That's not why I'm in there training them. I'm there so that if out of a room of 30, two of those officers want to make a change and they use these techniques and it changes their lives, that's why I'm there. So it's very interesting because everyone will wear their poker face, and then I give feedback forms at the end of every training. They're all anonymous, but I will have officers turn in these forms and then pull me aside. And the officer with the poker face all training has pulled me aside and says, where were you 15 years ago when I watched my marriage explode? I had an officer come to me. He had to leave the training halfway through, and he pulled me aside and he said, I'm leaving this training because I have to go to court again because I am inappropriate with people I'm supposed to serve, and I'm in trouble a lot. And if I had this training 10 years ago, my career would look different right now. Mm-hmm. These are stories I hear often from officers who will not let on in the middle of a training because they're there with their peers. But afterwards, they'll come up to me and they'll say these things. And some of them allow me to use their comments on my website. And for that, I'm extremely grateful because the more of those comments that I can put out there, the more other officers are speaking up about it. Yeah, I am vulnerable. I do need some assistance, and I'm ready for it. There's been this whole stigma around even admitting that you might not deal with your stress perfectly.
Yeah. Well, that's the double standard that we have, is that we're expected to deal with the world's problems day in and day out for 20, 30, 40 years, and then we're not allowed to have our own, and we're expected to be perfect and robot-like in managing our issues. And that's all well and good, but most of us have never gotten the training or the techniques to actually do that.
That's a pressure that nobody just has to handle. It's amazing. It's such an unrealistic paradigm that's been set up. The law enforcement world is there to serve me, the civilian. And if you do that, great. I'm not going to give you kudos. I'm going to say, well, that's your job. And if you don't do it perfectly, I'm going to condemn you. And media is quick to do that. And what I found is that there's an unrealistic pressure placed on those going into that field that they're not prepared to deal with. And it's not a fair situation by any means.
Yeah.
There are other professions who train their individuals for much, much longer with many more backup techniques, tools, and bags of tricks so that they can be healthy. And law enforcement is not one of them. The street training, the street survival training is fantastic, which of course it needs to be. You're dealing with mortality rates in the line of duty. But we're kind of getting a handle on that in this country because the death in the line of duty is pretty minimal.
Yeah.
So we're doing a great job at the street survival training. But when the suicide rates, you know, are double or triple what the death in the line of duty rates are, there's a serious need there, and agencies, some agencies are willing to start looking at that, and others still are, you know, maintaining that it's not a problem.
Right. Well, and I want to point out also that when you look at the line of duty death statistics for the last 10 years, more than half of the officers that die in the line of duty die an accidental death, even though when we talk about it, we talk about it like it's always the bad guys killing us. Running us over, shooting us, stabbing us, blowing us up. But that's not actually the case. It's usually less than half of the annual stats are people that have actually been feloniously murdered in the line of duty. And when you compare that to the suicide rate, you're talking about a rate that, depending on who you talk to, is between 4 and 6 times higher. And then if you add in other things like health issues and cancer and divorce and alcoholism, you know, this profession is toxic to be sure.
Yes, yes, it is. But there's a way to detox while you're in it and find the rewards of it. And that's really what I'm trying to do is get agencies to give me the time to come in and say, here's a filter for all of that toxic waste that you have. It's right here.
Yeah.
Use it. Take it.
And I, in my 20-plus year career, no one ever offered that to me, and that's why I was really drawn to what you're doing because, you know, every cop, I told you I was going to tease you about this. I want everybody listening to know that Lisa has passed the woo-woo test. She has some great techniques that, you know, we may not want to go through all the studying that she went through to get to this point, but she understands law enforcement, and she does not present this information in a way that's going to turn you off. It's stuff that you can use, and it is stuff that we need to be using. It's complementary to all of our other training that keeps us on red alert all the time and keeps us playing that what-if game. I was listening to you describe, you know, some of the things you're trying to back us down off of, and those are the things that we're trained to do every day, all day, playing the what-if game. What happens if I turn here and someone starts shooting at my patrol car? How am I going to get out of the car? And we just do that constantly, so we're on red alert most of the time, and we never have been taught a way to back that down, even on a normal day, much less a horribly stressful day.
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, your job warrants that you are on red alert, but then you go home. And cops have a really hard time not being cops when they're not in uniform. Cops are cops from the moment they take on that career to the moment they die. And it's one of the few professions that has such fierce loyalty, which is an amazing thing. And at the same time, when you are dealing with the most dysfunctional parts of society on a day-to-day basis, and you can't leave that stuff at work when you go home, then you create this worldview in your private life that matches your worldview in your work life. And most other people aren't cops. So what ends up happening is there is this growing disparity between your ability to relate to those around you in your personal world, your family, your children, your friends, and it's no surprise that down the road, cops usually only associate with other cops outside of work. And what that does is it keeps you perpetuating the world view that you are in at work, which is, I deal with the most dysfunctional portion of society. I deal with the world based on the remote possibility that something bad could happen in this interaction. And so your adrenaline is on all the time because you are in a heightened state of awareness because you're prepared for the 0.01 chance of something happening. And while that preparation may save your life someday, it will ruin your life up until that point if you can't find a way to compartmentalize work for the sake of work and the rest of the world for the sake of that.
I can so agree. One of the founding principles of copsalive.com is that, you know, anybody who takes on the responsibility to put on the uniform and wear the badge and go out and do this job day after day, year after year, deserves, I use the term, they deserve to get to Ollie Ollie oxen free. We deserve to get to a point where we can then give up that responsibility and live happily ever after. And yet when you look at the statistics, most cops, the life expectancy is 66 years. So many of us drink ourselves to death. So many of us commit suicide. So many people get to retirement and then they don't have any time left in their lives to enjoy the benefits of a good career and a good world. And it's a miserable existence, and nobody deserves that, least of all the peacekeepers of the world.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I got to watch that in my own family, too. You know, my cousin got to retire. He made it through alive. He got to retire. He supported his family, you know, the best he could and dismantled it as well in the process. Mm-hmm. And then when he retired, that's when the divorce came. That's when the animosity blew up, you know, with his children. That's when suddenly he's supposed to have this happily ever after, and now he's alone with addictions, with a broken family, mm-hmm. lost, and that's not how it's supposed to be.
Right.
You know, but that's unfortunately a lot of times how it is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not fair, and I think one of the reasons we're talking is that I believe that we as a profession are going to be the only people that are going to deal with this. You know, God bless you for stepping forward and saying, I can help you, but it is our responsibility as law enforcement professionals to say, look, we have a problem, and we deserve better, and we're going to take care of our own, and sort of like the airlines say, you know, put your own oxygen mask on first before you try to help somebody else. So if we're going to be successful in our careers, much less be able to get beyond that and live a happy life, happy and healthy, then we're going to need to learn to take care of ourselves. And you have some great tools and techniques that it can actually help people do that. And it kind of complements our other training, but it is another component that we have to add in or we're really missing something.
You know, and I'm glad you brought up that those in law enforcement have to step up and do it. I want to make something clear about the way I function and the way my company functions. I do not care to be the only one out there doing this. I do not care to have a monopoly on these techniques. I don't care to have a monopoly on creating preventative stress management, emotional survival trainings for law enforcement agencies. What I care is that I'm real good at talking. I can have a loud mouth sometimes. So I'm good at knocking on doors. But I know I have a really great piece, but I have a piece of what could be a comprehensive movement in law enforcement. And I am more inclined to say, I don't have the magic pill. I have a great pill, but it's not the end-all, be-all magic pill. Come work with me.
Right.
You've got your strengths. You're a former whatever with these strengths and these experiences. Come work with me. Let's do something together that's even more comprehensive. So right now, how I feel about what I'm doing is that I am opening the door and scratching the surface, and that there is a mountain underneath it of experience and know-how and industry people who could enhance the things I'm doing. And so I have a number of collaborative irons in the fire out there, because I would love to be going to an agency and saying, hey, here's my program plus two other components taught by, you know, you or you, and together we make up this group that will come in and do this mental warrior training for you.
Yep.
So this is not a competitive market in my approach. It's more of a, I'm looking for a collaborative market here. And sometimes that's the difference between some of the other programs I've been to. This is my proprietary program. You can't replicate it. And while I'm not interested in replicating anybody's hard work, I'm interested in collaborating. And so I'm happy to have this opportunity to collaborate with you right now in this interview and talk further about how you and I can affect a change, you know, down the road, and other agents, you know, former law enforcement personnel as well.
Well, and I want to say thank you for that, too, because, you know, there are over a million active law enforcement professionals just in the United States. And what I've found from my travels around the world is the issues we're talking about impact cops everywhere. It doesn't matter whether they're working in Pakistan or Argentina or Jamaica or Great Britain or Canada. It doesn't matter. We all have the same issues. And I talk about the term, you know, we carry a bucket around with us. And because of our job, we collect other people's crap. And that's the nature of the job. And you carry it around with you. You have some of your own stuff you put in there. And you collect more and more and more and more. And it starts to splash over. And it starts to splash over on your life and your family. And that's a description of a cop, no matter where they are, worldwide. And we, in my opinion, as a profession, need to sort of step up. And I'll be the first to say, I'm retired. This is my chance to give back a little bit to the profession that I loved, and try to help those that are coming after me, because I still think that law enforcement is the most noble profession on earth, and we have an obligation to not only take care of our communities, but we have an obligation to take care of ourselves. And, you know, no one's getting left behind here. And I commend you for stepping up and saying, hey, we have a problem and I have some solutions in here. Try this out.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for just giving me the time to even talk about it to this audience.
Well, I do want to say, and I am pleased to announce, one of the reasons that I asked to interview you is I want to welcome you into the Cops Alive family, because I've asked Lisa to be a regular contributor to Cops Alive. We're so impressed with what she's doing that we've asked her to contribute to our blog, and I'm certain this probably won't be the last time we're talking with her, and we're going to do everything we can to promote what she's doing so that agencies around the world get an idea that, hey, there is something we can do. And I think there are plenty of people out there that know there's a problem, but they're frozen without a solution. And then we'll have to deal with all those, and there are many that don't recognize there's a problem to begin with, and that's, you know, kind of what my job is here, is to kind of raise awareness. But I want to say thank you for what you're doing, and I want to welcome you to Cops Alive, because we really need what you have to offer, and I appreciate your generosity in making that available.
Well, thank you. It's a platform that I'm really honored to be a part of, and I'm very excited to be part of it, really.
Thank you.
I was very, very, very happy after our conversation when we first met, and very excited to be on board.
Thanks. And I am not going to let you off this easily, because I think there are plenty of other things we can talk about, but particularly, you have shared with me some personal details about what you've experienced in your life, and I'm going to ask you to share some of that, because, you know, I've already given you carte blanche acknowledgement that she's passed my woo-woo test, and she knows what she's talking about, and she is a person that actually practices what she preaches. And you have shared some amazing personal stories with me about what you've experienced in your life and how this stuff works for you. And if you don't mind, I'd like you to share some of that.
No, I don't mind at all. In fact, the other day I was thinking back when I was sharing all of that with you, I was thinking back and I thought, when you grow up, you think you're growing up like everybody else. You think you're growing up normally until it dawns on you or someone brings to your attention that that's not normal. And you say, whoa, maybe that's not normal. And so it really goes back to when I was a child and I started learning sort of a way to go into my nervous system and calm myself down. Because it really stemmed from the very first real traumatic incident that I remember. I was, my brother and I had a little accident together when I was about 11, and he ended up accidentally cutting my right eye open, the actual eyeball. And I was very traumatized by the physical trauma of it all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had to go in for surgery, and they did not know if I was going to see again, you know, and they had to stitch my eyeball back together. And, of course, for the next 3 months, I had to wear a goofy little plastic patch and go to school, and I didn't get to even see my eye for months.
Mm-hmm.
While the stitches were healing, and the prognosis was going to be, well, let's see what happens afterwards. But during those 3 months, I had to go very quickly from anger to denial to acceptance to navigation capabilities, because I thought I was going to be blind in one eye. And so I had to move very quickly through those phases, because I don't do well with a victim mentality. It really hurts me to be in that victim role. So I used these techniques, which I had learned a version of these when I was about 11 years old. I was using them to calm my body down and to start erasing that victim programming so that I could be functional. And I recovered 100% from that incident. And that was, I was 11. And then on my 15th birthday, I was hit by lightning, which was quite traumatic. It was another boy and I were both hit at the same time, and about 8 of our friends watched us fly through the air, I don't know, 4 or 5 feet, and land face first in the dirt. And we just got up and were probably in shock and brushed it off, and as though, did that really happen? And I remember my watch had stopped at the moment that we got hit, and the parents that were not there didn't believe us, but for years my lower back, where I had gotten hit, was so hypersensitive that I couldn't even touch my lower back in a certain angle. It would send these almost like sparks. And I had to, again, use these techniques to sort of calm my nervous system down and say, okay, move on. Whatever the damage is, move on. And it didn't occur to me that there was much damage right away, because physically I looked and appeared fine. But what then started happening was I became highly vasovagal, which is a condition they call it syncope, and it's people who pass out easily. But mine was really severe, where I would black out, and then I would seizure, and then I would flatline, and I never knew what was happening, because I was usually alone when it happened, until one day when I was much older, I was actually in a doctor's exam, and I had a vasovagal seizure, and I woke up to him with a needle of atropine over my chest, saying, there's no pulse, there's no breathing, we have to inject her. And I came out of it, you know, in what was familiar to me as having had these episodes before, and he said, you flatlined. And those episodes usually take a day or two to actually recuperate, because when you seizure like that, all of your muscles contract so hard that you use up all of your available energy. There's nothing left to move afterwards. So you're pretty much in bed for about a day or two. And the really, really intense ones that were really hard for me to come back from, where I could actually hear the people in the room and witness them from sort of outside my body, those happened, you know, on 3 or 4 occasions, once in front of my daughter in a supermarket. She asked if I was dead, and that was a really hard conversation to have with a 3-year-old.
Yeah.
When she said, Mommy, did you die? And, well, technically the answer is, I think so, but no, because I'm still here. You know, and another time it happened, and there was my fiancé, you know, trying to pull me back, and at that particular time I think I had, there was no pulse and no breathing for like 4 or 5 separate bouts of time during an hour. And of him trying to pull me back. So I never thought that was abnormal. I had no idea that
I think you're a candidate for the Guinness Book of World Records. So it
I had no
abnormal.
Idea that that was actually something bizarre until it really happened in the doctor's office and he had the needle of atropine. And then I thought, oh, something might not be right. And he was panicked, and he said, I didn't know you were vasovagal to this extent. And I said, well, I don't even know what that is. And that's really where the biological explanation came. But that all started right after the lightning strike. You know, it started that summer right after the lightning strike, but I had never correlated those two things. I had just used my tools and techniques to, okay, it happened again. I'm going to go in and I'm going to repair my nervous system so that I can be functional because I don't have a choice. And that's kind of the mentality. And then the other real traumatic episode that I spent days in this place of using these techniques was I was 19 and I had a chemistry accident and spilled super concentrated hydrochloric acid into both my eyes and up my nose. And I had just burnt all the nerve endings in both my eyeballs and my sinuses. And my eyeballs hemorrhaged for 3 months. I mean, just hemorrhaged blood. It was horrible, and they did not think I would recuperate at all from that. And I remember sitting there in my parents' bed. They had taken me out of school, and I was sitting in my parents' bed, and I remember being, you know, on the phone with my boyfriend who wasn't there at the time, and I remember saying, I don't think I'm ever going to see you again. And he thought I meant we were breaking up, and I said, no, I don't think I'm going to see you again. And I remember spending days in my parents' bed using these techniques to stop the trauma and the nightmares, and then just move on from it. And and outwardly, it must have appeared that, well, it's no big deal. She seems to handle these things okay. But inwardly, I was methodically moving through the phases of, okay, here's the victim. I'm the victim. Why did this happen to me? But if I stay here, nothing's getting better. So let me find a way to navigate to turning down the adrenaline, accepting the situation, finding ways to navigate through it and solve it and moving on to something new, whatever that may be. And, you know, by the grace of whatever being is watching over me, I make these recoveries. But it's the physical trauma that I have experienced that I have used to prove to myself the validity of these tools. I don't use them in a vacuum. I don't use them theoretically in a classroom. I use them to survive. I use them to pull myself back and say, I have to be here and functional for my daughter, and I don't have a choice, and so I better find a way to do that. But I better find a way to do that without denying that the trauma is actually happening to me.
Well, and I want to emphasize from what I know of all that you do, we're not just talking about people that are in extreme trauma and cops that are already to the point of PTSD, which most of us will deny we don't have any of that. But we're talking about day-to-day stuff. And what I hear loud and clear is you're not only helping us recognize when some of these things are happening, but then giving us the tools to deal with it day-to-day so that it doesn't become that overflowing bucket that that ruins our lives.
Exactly. And, you know, I use this analogy. You don't brush your teeth once and expect them to be clean for the rest of your life. If you don't continue to brush them, you're going to build up plaque. You're going to get gingivitis. You're going to lose your teeth, and you're going to have, you know, just a horrible mouth. So that's what these tools are. They're great to scrape the intense plaque off your teeth, but they're also great to use every single day so you don't get the plaque in the first place. It's maintenance. Yeah. There's nothing that, in my experience, that you can do once that cures everything forever. It's a process, and if you don't engage in that process, then you let the process take you where it wants to go. But if you engage in it on a daily basis with maintenance, then you get to shape your world in a way that works for you.
Well, and, you know, I know there are plenty of police academies out there that are trying to equip new officers with every tool and technique that they're going to need to, you know, endure a career in law enforcement. And yet I think we're still sorely lacking, and we need all the tools we can find. And I appreciate you saying, hey, these may not be the end all, but I've got something that can help you, and then keep looking for others. And And I think, again, that it comes back to us as a professional. The minute you hit the streets, you're out of the academy, then the onus is on you to be finding the tools and the strategies that are going to help you survive. And when you take on a family and you have kids, you know, that just ups the ante. And sometimes we're pretty reckless about that, and we need to be responsible, and we've got to take care of ourselves. And I think it's good that we can start offering them some tools to actually do that.
Yeah, and I have to say that I think there was a reason that I started this business while I was in Colorado, because the Colorado market, their ears are open, and I seriously think that for all of the agencies that have their ears closed, there's as many agencies that really have their ears open. They just have to be approached in the right way, and I'm happy to say that as of yesterday, the sixth police agency in Colorado has signed on with me. And I'm not talking about one-on-ones. I'm talking about the sixth agency that is bringing me in now to say, yes, give this to our officers. And so I feel very honored that they're open to it and listening, and that I have a chance to go in and affect change. And for all the agencies that have said no, I just keep calling them.
Yes, I know that you are persistent, and I say, go, girl. You just keep up the hard work, because, you know, I like to think that we're progressive in the place where I live, and I'm thrilled that you're, you know, a neighbor. But I still talk frequently with people all around the world, either by phone or by Skype, and we're all in the same boat. And you know, law enforcement is kind of a stubborn, closed profession, and, you know, shame on us, but we're the ones that have to open the doors, and it takes each individual officer to kind of reach out and say, hey, I'd like to learn that. You know, more power to all the chiefs and leaders in law enforcement that are saying, hey, we need to provide more of this, because I think I heard you say it, you know, you can take a worker that's burning out and actually costing your agency, or can cost your agency, a tremendous amount, and turn them around to becoming the most productive of workers. I can't phrase that as well as you can. Would you mind sharing that?
Yeah, well, you know, in some cases I have been asked to teach these techniques and tools to, for lack of a better term, what people label like the bottom performers or the troublemakers or you know, that type of thing. And and it's those people who are ready to make a change and want to make a change and learn these tools and techniques and all of a sudden become the star performer.
Right.
And that's not a rare story. Once you learn how to navigate the invisible world of your nervous system, people recognize your clarity and your ability to do that, and all of a sudden you become this efficient star performer. It's not only visible to yourself, it becomes very outwardly visible. And that has happened on numerous occasions where I've gone in and taught these techniques. And one of my private clients, who is an officer in another state, has experienced this herself, and I've been working with her for a number of months now, remotely, so over the phone, teaching her these techniques, and it's really helped her to gain footing in a very troubled path that she found herself on, to the point where, you know, her sergeant noticed and said, "Wow, what's different? What are you doing?" And so those are the things I work for too, is to have the people right on, you know, on in the day to day who are just not cutting it, be able to turn it all around and stay in the profession they love for the reasons they love to be there, instead of getting stuck.
Yeah, we all love to joke about the burnouts, but I think if we actually took a hard look in the mirror, every one of us has experienced burnout, in my case, a number of times in my career for different reasons. And, you know, being able to turn some of that around, some of it, I'm not sure we can, but some things, you know, you can actually turn around if you get rid of some of the baggage that you're carrying around. And I hear that loud and clear with everything you're saying.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even if law enforcement professional just simply wanted the most basic benefit of these techniques. The most basic benefit of these techniques is that it will help you turn down your adrenaline, and that will save your life in the long run. So even at its basest form, it is in your direct health benefit to use these, because adrenaline over time will kill you no matter who you are.
Yeah. Thank you, Lisa, very much. Is there anything else that you want to share with us?
I'm just really excited to have this opportunity to work with Cops Alive, and I'm excited that there seems to be a shift and people are open to admitting a need and finding a solution for that need. That just seems like the way the world should be.
Hallelujah to that. Well, I want to thank you for being our guest today, and we will look forward to seeing you and hearing from you in the future. I want to thank our guest. She is Lisa Wimberger, the founder and president of Trance Personnel Consulting Group. You can find her on the web at www.tpconsultinggroup.com. That's tpconsultinggroup.com. And there will be a link to her site from Cops Alive as we put her up as a regular contributor on Cops Alive. I want to thank all of you for listening. This has been another edition of Cops Alive Audio Bulletin. I'm John Marks, the editor, and I just want to remind you that our goal in life is to help law enforcement professionals plan for happy, healthy, and successful lives both on the job and beyond. And I think Lisa has given us some hope and some strategies, and we will definitely hear more from her. Thank you all, and stay safe.